This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. It is because of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, ratified on August 18th, 1920, that I can vote in the upcoming California primary. I don't think I have ever been so clear about that truth. And as you know, if you're a longtime listener, I don't turn these stories around very often to make them about me. But if you too are a woman, to just pause and think about that is so remarkable. I can't imagine not being able to vote. But the ratification of the 19th Amendment was a finish line, and that permanent change to women's status as American citizens, it does not say a lot at that moment about the battle, but oh, what a battle it was. And earlier this week, you might have heard my conversation with Sac State historian Dr. Mona Siegel. She talked about women's surging political power 100 years ago. Today, I am thrilled to welcome Dr. Joanna Newman to Insight because she has traced 200 years of this history. Her new book is titled, And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. Dr. Newman, so glad to have you here.
Thank you, Beth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Have you had that same kind of moment that I just described when suddenly the white light shines on this reality?
For me, the story is more, as you said, about two centuries of struggle to win the vote. Most suffrage histories begin in 1848 when Elizabeth Cady Stanton stood up at Seneca Falls, New York, and said women should have the right to vote. It was extremely controversial. Her husband boycotted the meeting for fear it would hurt his political career, and her co-sponsor, Lucretia Mott, a Quaker, said to her, Lizzie, thee will make us ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And they end their histories in 1920 when, as you said, the 19th Amendment was enacted. But when I was studying the history, I noticed that women in this country started agitating for the vote during the first flush of revolutionary fervor in the colonies. And some women, like Abigail Adams, actively fought for a voice for women. And the history goes all the way to the 1960s, when African American women in the South, technically enfranchised by the 19th Amendment, but prevented from voting by Jim Crow laws that imposed draconian literacy tests and poll taxes, they went back into the streets to fight for the Voting Rights Act. So it's two centuries, eight generations, pure persistence.
Your book begins with a woman named Lydia Taft. Mm-hmm. And the very, very first story. I think you can tell it in a brief way for us, but that's a name we don't know in history, and I want people to know her name.
Lydia Chapin Taft was a widow of a very wealthy man in a town called Uxbridge, Massachusetts. And after his death, the townspeople invited her to come to town meeting and vote. She was the largest taxpayer in their town, and they knew that her funds would be needed to contribute militarily to the French and Indian Wars. She voted three times in the 1750s, and twice in the 1750s, once in the 1760s, and she is known, not widely, as you said, but she is known as America's first female voter, recorded voter.
Your book contains so many stories like that, and I've heard you say that at one point you were challenged by a mentor to come up with a list of 200 women, and in this case, it was the wealthy socialites in circles, perhaps, in New York, who were somehow involved, had an opinion, or were gathering. And that challenge to you took your research in a certain direction. Why were so many women so unknown?
You know, I think that's a wonderful question. I think the whole topic of suffrage is usually segregated in a little corner of our history. And one of my goals for this book is to reintegrate the topic into the meta-narrative of American history. So you will note in this book there are chapters in which the Civil War is a character, mm-hmm. or World War I shows up, or the voting, the civil rights. These are moments when our history is the nation's history.
Throughout all of this, there is a line here that sums it up, and you actually made me check some of my own writing and language on this. You write, "The guiding rule of suffrage history is that male politicians never cede power unless it advances them." And there is something to do with the language in whether women say they were granted or earned or fought for the right to vote.
Or won.
So it's worth saying something about the language we use.
And I also, that is also a reference to fact that in the case of women's suffrage, the states served as incubators for social change, especially in California. In 1911, California voters, who were all male at the time, went to the polls and enacted a ballot initiative to give women the right to vote. It was a very tight election. The initiative won by one vote per precinct, but it had enormous dramatic effect because by 1912, 1.2 million American women could vote for president. 4 years later, many more states had enfranchised women. And it was said by analysts that Woodrow Wilson would not have been reelected without their votes. And what happens is by the time 1919 Congress is considering this amendment, women show up to lobby. They're not like Susan B. Anthony of a previous generation who was coming as a petitioner. They come as constituents. And I think that made all the difference. Mm.
1919 is a point in time that we were talking about earlier this week with the Paris Peace Treaty. But in the story you just told, if I was one of the men who cast that ballot, why wouldn't I think I gave women the right to vote because I voted in favor of it?
Well, you might think that, but my point is that no one cedes power unless it advantages them. So the advantage might be altruistic or philosophical, but it's calculated.
Your book is being praised and cheered. It is far and deep for a casual reader, an academic. You and I are going to carry this conversation into tomorrow, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
We will be at Sac State. There is a noon event that begins at 12:30. It's open to the public as long as space is allowed. And then we'll be in conversation and take audience questions from 1 to 2 tomorrow afternoon. But this is a continuing book event and lecture opportunity that you've given people across the country. What are you hearing back when audiences go through some of this long history? In one case, there's a story here that a 24-year-old school teacher in 1926 cast a ballot, and it would take her 31 more years to be able to continue the right to vote.
That's the shocker. Really, that's the shocker. And people are identifying with these women. They are resonating to the excavation of their lives. You mentioned that I had a mentor who encouraged me to gather a spreadsheet of information about 200 of my, in my first book, it was called Gilded Suffragists, these socialites who embraced the movement in the 1910s. And they were the media darlings of their day. they were celebrated for every excess of clothing and decor and travel. But when they embraced the movement, it was like Oprah spotlighting a cause today. Mm. It just put enormous attention on this issue that had been in the doldrums. And I think for many people reacting, the excavation, it took me 6 months to find out what I needed to find out about those 200 socialites. Sometimes all I started with in the morning was a name that wasn't theirs. It was Mrs. Husband's name. Mm-hmm. And I went through census records and newspaper accounts, obituaries, birth records. It sometimes took me a whole day. But if at the end of the day I had her first name and her maiden name, I felt like I had contributed to history. And that's what I've tried to do here, too.
I want to correct what I just said, because that school teacher registered to vote in 1926. It was then 31 years later, as you write, in 1957, when she actually cast her first vote. Speaking of names, though, tell the story of Elizabeth Arden.
Oh, one of my favorite stories. Elizabeth Arden was born Florence Nightingale Graham. She was an immigrant from Canada, and she came to New York, and she wanted to open a beauty store for women.
She is, in fact, that Elizabeth
Arden. And she
Arden.
Changed her name to mm-hmm. Elizabeth Arden, yeah. And she was not very political. And she shocked her staff one day when she announced that she was leaving work at lunchtime to go march in a suffrage parade. And one of the staffers said to her, "But Miss Arden, I didn't know you were for suffrage." And she said, "Well, I'm not, but our clients are." Hmm. The other thing, when I mentioned earlier about the campaigns in the states, initiatives put before, what I think won eventually for suffrage was so many failures. I think sometimes we underestimate how the import of failure to the eventual success. And so for Arden, the tide had shifted, public opinion had changed, the fangs had been diffused in this very radical issue that Elizabeth Cady Stanton had first suggested that sent her husband packing.
I'm talking with Dr. Joanna Newman. Her book is And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. If you'd like to see us in person and hear this conversation continue tomorrow, we have posted a link at capradio.org/insight. We'll fill the room if we can tomorrow, so please join us. I had an interesting dip into your past when I found a video of you working for USA Today as a journalist interviewing President Ronald Reagan. And it seems like this was just at the very beginnings. Maybe inauguration hadn't happened yet for his second term in office.
Wow. You do good work.
you were co-interviewing with another journalist who was talking about more of the economics. And even then, you were asking him to put his presidency, his legacy, his decisions in the context of history. So tell me, in your journalism career, as a straightforward journalism, how you framed what you would do with your work and your research and your writing.
I think I had a narrator's. I always loved narrative writing. My favorite job as a journalist, though it may sound ghoulish, to learn that newspapers do advanced obituaries on famous people mm-hmm. because you want to give import to the life of important people. And my favorite job was writing them because they were like mini biographies. And I used to joke that writing obits was the only time in journalism that you could be kind, you know, that you could mention the falls along the road, but you could give that person the arc of their life. You could send them off. And I think that sense of narrative storytelling affected my journalism.
And just so I understand, you would write these obituaries while the person was still alive.
Yes.
Yes. And yes. So they were ready.
They were ready.
Which is a common practice.
And I did do Ronald Reagan's. I am a native of California. I'm from Los Angeles. And when the Los Angeles Times, I left USA Today for the LA Times Washington Bureau. And when the LA Times published the Reagan obituary, my mother called me and said, "Your name has never appeared so big in print." Mm-hmm. So, but it's a family heirloom as well as an archive document.
Well, I certainly hear that narrative voice in the work that you've done in your books, and you have focused a lot of it on the journey for women. Your mother or your grandmother, any of us seeing the daughter's name in print or the sister or the girlfriend's name in print, this is all still new enough that's important. It's remarkable.
You know, I dedicated this book to the four women of my past generation, my mother and my three aunts, and to the young girls of my future generation. One of them is a 3.5-year-old girl who lives in Atlanta. Her mother is my niece, and her name is Arden. And I have a picture of Arden looking at the dedication of this book. And I look at that picture and wonder, what is she thinking? Does she know? Will she read this one day? But I do think it's a legacy that we have from the earlier generations to pass on to the next.
Dr. Newman, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, it has. Thank you.
And I look forward to much more time to be spent with you tomorrow afternoon.
I do as well. Thank you.
Dr. Joanna Newman, the book is And Yet They Persisted. You can find more at capradio.org/insight. I do want to let you know that we will continue to update the coverage of the plane crash in Australia, three Americans were on board. There were no survivors. That will happen at capradio.org because on the air in just a few minutes, you will hear NPR's Gavel to Gavel special coverage of the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. Thanks for listening. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Helen Barrington and Kyle McKinnon. Assistant producer is Cynthia Lopez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Anthony Van Hook. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Stay with us for much more news throughout the day and into the evening at Cap Radio. And thanks for joining us.